the lantern among in the middle of red brick buildings at the university campus of Jyväskylä. Alvar Aalto has designed this all, and this small white building should shed light, academic light, to the campus and now to the world also. On my left hand there is the defendant Torbjörn Sievert. On my right hand is second supervisor of Torbjörn, Dr. Marko Haapakoski, who is also in charge for the video streaming. And I will be custodian, the chairman of the defense. Sorry for the disturbance in the beginning. The pointed, of course, and online in the most important person in Stockholm, Anand Professor Anders Angerbjörn, is acting as opponent for Torbjörn Sievert today. Appointed by the Faculty of Mathematics and Natural Sciences of the University of Jyväskylä, I declare the public defense of Torbjörn Sievert's thesis open.
Distinguished custos, honored opponent, ladies and gentlemen. Whenever I start talking about my research, I like to start with a quote from Lima and Dill, two very influential ecologists who dedicated a lot of their academic life investigating predator-prey interactions. Few failures, however, are as unforgiving as a failure to avoid a predator. Being killed greatly decreases future fitness. I think this quote shows the importance of predator-prey interactions and highlights the urgent need for prey species to adapt to predation risk. Today, the quote sets the scene for the rest of my lecture. But let's start from the beginning. Decades of research have been dedicated to the study of predator-prey interaction. These interactions are a major evolutionary driver, leading to an arms race in physiological and behavioral changes. Since most of us are now confined at home, take a moment to look out of your window. I hope you will see some birds looking for food, maybe even a squirrel, mouse, or if you are very lucky, a deer. If you observe their behaviors for a few seconds, what will you see? Most likely, you will see foraging behavior interrupted by moments where the animals are looking around, scanning the environment for potential threats. Maybe you saw a flock of birds taking flight in unison, started by a noise or movement. All this is a result of coevolutions between predator and prey. Historically, research has been very focused on consumptive effects. This means how many, for example, wolves, deer, or lemmings, have been eaten by predators, and how does this loss of individuals result in population changes for the next couple of generations. There's a vast body of literature on how to interpret a monolithic interaction, the earliest and probably best known proposed by Lotke and Volterra in 1925. However, in the last few decades, the research focus has been shifting away from direct motility to literally every other aspect of predator-prey relations. Saying everything else sounds vague, but this is because the mere presence of a predator affects several aspects of a prey species' life. Throughout my lecture, I hope to explain some of them. I mentioned before that prey species adapt to predators. So what are these adaptations? Adaptations can be quite varied. They can be physiological or morphological, impacting how the animal functions and looks, or they can be behavioral. First, we need to realize that there are two major groups of adaptations: constitutive, so always present, and induced, only present when needed. A good example of constitutive adaptations are quills in porcupines, or to go with a local example, spines in hedgehogs. When it comes to the mentioned induced changes, we speak about a variety of possible adaptations. They reach from simple mechanisms like freezing, escaping, or avoidance, to induced morphological changes, changes in reproductive strategies, or even changes in the offspring. The latter would be the transgenerational effects mentioned in the title of my dissertation. When we talk about induced adaptations, it means that prey species are able to detect predators, While this seems like an obvious fact at first glance, it also means that there have been dozens of studies examining the details. Prey species can employ a range of cues involving all of their senses to detect predators. Rather than going through the different senses now, it is more useful to be aware of two major groups of cues, direct and indirect predator cues. Unfortunately for us, the definition varies a lot between authors. For the sake of clarity, for the remainder of my lecture, and throughout my thesis, I use the following definitions. A direct predator cue originates from the predator itself, while an indirect cue originates from the individual of the same prey species. Indirect cues are used by prey individuals to communicate with each other and come in different forms. The most commonly observed indirect predator cue are alarm calls. These alarm calls are used by birds, meerkats, primates, and several other mammal species. But alarm calls can also carry more nuanced information. Depending on species, it can carry information about the size of the predator, the color, or even more detailed, for example, whether it is an avian or terrestrial predator. However, alarm calls are not the only indirect cues. Pheromones, which are chemicals used to communicate within the same species, or more specifically, alarm pheromones, are commonly observed in different fish and insect species. As the use of laboratory rodents is abundant in academic literature, it is not surprising that currently the majority of studies on mammalian alarm pheromones are focused on rats and mice. So far, there has been very limited evidence for the existence of alarm pheromones and its effect in wild mammalian species. As the cover picture and the title gave away, I worked with bankfold and least weasels as model species throughout the last 4 years. Bankfolds, the prey, are a very abundant rodent species throughout Europe. They have an extremely quick reproduction cycle throughout the summer months, which in practice means they mate, are pregnant for 21 days, give birth, can immediately mate again, and are pregnant while caring for the previous litter. This can be repeated several times throughout the summer. As the litter consists of 4 to 5 pups on average, and the wool pups become sexually mature after about 30 days, you can imagine the number of wools you have after just a couple of generations. Additionally, wool populations fluctuate along a multi-year cycle, causing population peaks every 3 to 4 years. While wools do not cause much harm in health ecosystems, we live in a world where healthy, pristine ecosystems are a rarity, and thus large numbers of wools could become a burden. In southern Finland alone, all these wool species caused forestry damages of around 20 million euros in 2008. Luckily for us and ecosystems, bankfolds have an efficient and vicious predator, the least weasel. Do not be fooled by its looks. The weasel's slender body allows it to follow wolves practically everywhere. Due to its ability to change its coat with the season, brown in summer and white in winter, weasels are perfectly adapted to hunt wolves throughout the year. Weasels are such adaptive wolf hunters that practically every direct encounter between the two results in a dead wolf. It is not surprising then that weasels are often considered to be the main cause of mortality in boreal wolves. But wolves have evolved a range of adaptations, which brings us to the experiment I conducted throughout my thesis. I will not go into the details of each and every experiment, but as a general theme, you should know that I took odor of the predator, the least weasel, and alarm pheromones from the wolves who had just encountered a weasel, and use these two odors as the main treatment. I then presented wolves with the different odors and checked how it affected their behavior, their reproduction, and if any changes in the offspring could be observed. Additionally, I collected the volatile alarm pheromone for analysis in order to identify the chemical components involved. So, what did I find? First and foremost, when wolves are presented with the alarm pheromone during mating, it results in more litters being born. This did not occur for animals presented with a predator odor. The increase in litters can be interpreted as a sign of terminal investment. Under the terminal investment hypothesis, individuals maximize their reproductive output when faced with extreme risk or stress, while ignoring all consequences for their own fitness. The assumption is that if a single offspring reaches sexual maturity, it compensates for the investment or even death of the parent. Assuming that we see signs of terminal investment involved, it means that bank vaults associate different risk levels with different odors. In practice, this means that the indirect alarm pheromone of another vault is a sign of a higher or more urgent threat than the direct odor of a predator. Keeping this in mind, the offspring of vaults treated with a direct predator odor were heavier shortly after birth. Bank vaults have therefore evolved adaptations to change their reproductive outputs and the fitness of the offspring according to the perceived threat level in the environment. Having made this discovery, I looked more closely at how the behavior of offspring changes in response to how the parents are treated. In short, I looked at the transgenerational effect. While there is a big body of literature on transgenerational effects, in most of the work, the animals are tested in neutral environments. I decided to take this a step further in my experiments and to also present the vole pup with either predator, odor, or alarm pheromone. This revealed that the transgenerational changes in behavior are highly context dependent. It means that depending on how the parents were treated, the vole pups reacted differently to a completely neutral environment compared to odors in their environment. In contrast to previous studies, I only found signs of increased anxiety in the offspring in neutral environments, but not when presented to the alarm pheromone or the predator odor. I also looked at how the timing of the treatment affects the offspring, so if there's a difference whether the parent is treated before or after giving birth. Surprisingly, there was no difference. This shows that adaptations in the offspring can be reliably induced no matter when the threat occurs. Lastly, I analyzed the chemical composition of vole alarm pheromone and found a group of 10 components which are likely relevant for the observed changes. Going into detail for this aspect of my work is tricky, as no other studies have observed or let alone analyzed alarm pheromones in mammals, apart from the already mentioned usual suspects, rats and mice. Up to now, there has been little research on chemical alarm communications in wild mammals. My work fills an important knowledge gap as it shines a light at the importance of alarm pheromones in mammals and the ability of species to alter their reproductive strategies based on information from the environment. Especially terminal investment in mammals has so far been an overlooked aspect in mammalian predator-prey relations, even though it is well documented in different taxa, for example, insects. Additionally, the context-dependent transgenerational effects will likely be a topic of interest in the future, as my results show a strong contrast to the previously established results. However, the understanding of the small details in predator-prey interactions are not only academic brain exercises. Rapid environmental changes are looming in the near future. In order to understand or even potentially mitigate some of the resulting effects to ecosystems, it is essential that we have a good idea of how all the small gears work. Even without environmental changes, the understanding of predator-prey interactions has an impact on the society level. In recent years, the efforts to incorporate these mechanisms into efficient pest control strategies have shown great success and will, hopefully, be expanded in the future. I hope that the finer nuances and details of my work will become clear in the now following detailed examination. Honorable Professor Angerbier, as opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for.
Thank you, Torbjörn. I wonder, is it my turn now?
Yes, I think yes. It is.
Okay. So this is a thesis about the relationship between predator and prey species. The nature of this relationship leads to an evolutionary arms race with co-evolutionary changes for both the predator and the prey. However, sublethal processes are also important, where the fear of a predator can have strong consequences both physiologically and with reproductive changes. to detect predator presence and to communicate this with individuals from your own species, it's a central theme in this thesis. This communication can be done in several ways, such as possible behavioral changes, escape, avoidance, vigilance, and even mobbing. But in the thesis by Torbjörn Sievert, the scent cues are in focus. Direct ones through the scent of a predator and indirect one through the scent of alarm pheromones from the prey. But I will just point out in this very brief introduction how central the issues in this thesis are, especially in the current situation where humans are attacked by a new predator, the coronavirus. So from the thesis, we have an overall discussions about, we have an evolutionary arms race where the virus has adopted to attack humans. And there are many sublethal processes in this process. They're also lethal. So there is risk and fear, central themes in the thesis, the cost of fear. So this phenomenon is also then very central in the human societies today. And the communication about risk and fear, also central issues from the thesis, are also very central for the human communication today. There are behavioral changes. We see them in humans. We see them in voles. They escape, they avoid, and they try to be vigilant. And all these behavioral changes can be seen in both voles and humans and all other prey species. There are also physiological and evolutionary changes. This goes also parallel in voles and humans. So with this very brief introduction, I'd like to point out how general and central the issues from these theses are and how they can be applied to many other cases than the focus in the thesis. So with that, I think that we can continue the discussion more in details. So I like to share you the screen that we will see if the communication will work. Let's see, I should also do. Something like that.
Yes, perfect.
So, Torbjörn, it's very nice to be your opponent, and I hope that we will have a nice discussion about this. So, this is your overview about the experiment and the methods. And I must say, it is impressive. It's very nice with the combination about different experiments, the combination of laboratory experiment and field experiments. And also that is backed up in some physiological and chemical measurements also. So, and also the theory is always there and the predictions are clear and the experiments are trying to focus really on these predictions. But I think there are a lot of things to be discussed anyhow. So the general parts here. So I lost a picture, but that doesn't matter. So what I first like to discuss was the terminology into your title, predation. What is predation and what is a predator? So what do you think?
Are we now talking about a very broad definition, or are we talking about a very narrow definition for voles and smaller mammals?
Well, that's up to you.
I mean,
we need to sort of see where the generality are in the discussion and the items.
Okay, then when I first start to point out the bigger picture, I would say a predator is any other being that has a negative impact on a prey species. Is it either via direct mortality, so by eating it or attacking it, or an indirect effect by causing physiological changes that cause negative fitness for the affected prey?
So you do basically agree that the coronavirus is a predator?
I mean, in a very broad speaking, yes, that could definitely be a one aspect.
What about a cattle? Could a vole also be a predator?
a vole can definitely be a predator to plants. And since voles eat plants and deteriorate the plants' well-being by opening up wounds where the infections can enter, I would argue that voles can be plant predators.
So what's the difference then between a weasel being a predator on voles and voles being predators on plants?
I mean, technically, just that weasels and voles are both vertebrates, while voles and plants are not. Besides that, I would say that the differences are vague at best and highly depends on how you define a prey and a predator.
Yes, here you are. This was the figure that I was looking for. So the question is then where the theory is coming in. Why are some predators a lot bigger than their prey and some predators are a lot smaller than their prey? And what's the consequences of this?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I think it mainly depends how the predator attacks its prey. I mean, if we talk about weasels and voles, the weasel is not so much bigger than the vole. It's about, let's say, 2 to 3 times bigger, but it still needs the physical power to attack successfully a vole. On the other hand, weasels also attack hares and other lagomorphs, where then the size difference is the other way around. So I don't think it's a matter of size between the prey and the predator. It's more how the two act within between each other.
So why are the parasites also being predators? Why are they then so much smaller than their prey?
I mean, I guess because it's easier to hide. I mean, that's a very general aspect, but if we now talk about parasites, for example, ticks, if you would have the tick the size of a vole, it would be very quickly spotted on your body and could potentially be ripped off if you move as a deer through a very thick forest. But with ticks being the size that they are big enough to sustain themselves while being small enough to not be a too big burden for their host or to risk any adverse effects due to their body size.
Yes, we could stop there. I mean, your thesis is mostly about behavior and scent cues. This discussion and your thesis has also a population ecology perspective. We will see in the end if we can have time to go into that as well. But let's continue with the title and alarm pheromones. You have described this and defined this fairly clear, but there is a discussion about it. Can you go into that a little bit?
The discussion is mainly a matter of definition. I mean, when you talk to a scientific audience about pheromones, there are a lot of underlying assumptions what pheromones can or cannot do. So with this, and some of them think that pheromones are this magic odor that floats around and that makes animals or humans do whatever the pheromones tells them to do. But I tried to move away from this definition throughout the chapters, and I try to make that as clear as possible in my introduction that for me, a pheromone has no secret magical component. It is purely to communicate with individuals of the same species.
Yeah, I think that's okay. But what about the predator odor? Couldn't that also be a pheromone with the communication for between weasel and weasel?
By definition, not. That would be an allomone, I think, maybe because there are very strict definitions for that. For example, an odor of of the individual of one species that delivers information to another species and has a negative impact on the sending species. So for example, a weasel sends its body odors to the vole, and the vole is aware of the weasel, which is arguably a negative effect for the weasel. Those would then be chiromones and no longer pheromones.
Yes, I think we will come back to this discussion, but we continue with the broader pictures here in the beginning. What about risk versus perceived risk?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a bit tricky. I mean, a vole is not sure that there is any actual risk until it's attacked, actually. I mean, and so, but if every prey species would only rely on a very 100% sure information of risk, so being directly attacked by a predator, I think that would have a very negative effect on prey populations overall. So they then rely on perceived risk levels, which are then a bit more vague. They assume that is a risk in their environment and they prepare for it. Of course, it is possible that they over or underestimate this risk, but on an evolutionary scale, the way they assess the risk means that they perceive risk level is with a very high likelihood more or less accurate.
I guess it is a risk versus fear a little bit,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is. I mean, a vole that has a high perceived threat level, you can argue that it is fearful, that it has increased anxiety, and that the behavior changed is based on that.
Yes, okay. We can come back to transgenerational effect, but if we continue the general issues, mm-hmm. Fitness is the basic entity with all evolutionary discussions. But you have distinguished fitness from individual fitness. Can you explain that?
I mean, in my opinion, it is difficult to talk about the fitness of a population, since fitness is always determined by the actions of a single individual. So for example, if to stick with my two preferred animals at the moment, voles and weasels, if a single vole individual decides, well, I don't care if there's alarm pheromone or predator odor around me, I'm just gonna run around and see what happens, and that individual gets eaten, it cannot pass on its genetic information to the next generation. It's just scratched from the gene pool. So with this in mind, I think the individual decision and the individual fitness is more explanatory than talking about a population level fitness.
Yeah, this is a big discussion, and a lot of colleagues would certainly not agree with you. Yes. Stephen Stearns wrote a paper many years ago where about the definition about fitness, and I don't remember how many different definitions he had. I think it was 7 or 9 different definitions, and some of them are certainly based on populations. For example, the population genetic definition is a change in gene frequency from one generation to the other. So, I think I'm a population ecologist, so I also think of it as a population measure. I'd rather use fish's reproductive value as a definition of fitness. But it's fine. We can continue to discuss this even if we don't agree in details about it, because fitness is such a wide theme. So we really need to keep it open and not to define it too hard. Mm-hmm. So, but another central issue in your thesis is terminal investment.
Yes.
And this is related, of course, then to the fitness.
Yes, definitely. I mean, talking about terminal investment in mammals is a bit controversial, to put it mildly. I've been giving talks about this, and I've been heavily attacked that you can't talk about terminal investment in mammals. Their generation spans are too long. But in my opinion, that might be a bit antiquated point of view, to be honest. I think what we see here, that an increased output for reproduction to really put everything that the world have into either increasing the litter sizes or to produce more litters is for me quite clearly a sign of terminal investment.
Yes, it's a matter of discussion, I think, to be able to show it. An old animal with a lot of experience has probably a better chance to survive than one that is just aged into sexual maturity. So the issue probably needs more detailed experiments and more detailed information on what's going on.
Absolutely.
We will continue to that in the specific papers. And you also discuss a behavioral response.
Yes.
Any further comments on that?
Personally, I'm not so averse to any physiological changes. Of course, behavioral changes are is a symptom of physiological changes. So of course, if we observe a vole not doing something or doing something more than we expect, of course we can then dig deeper to look into what underlying physiological changes we observe. But I think as a first assessment of what is going on, it is a fairly solid proxy.
So one important part of the behavior is the communication.
Yes.
And in the communication, for example, the alarm pheromone, the theoretical framework is that you do have a sender and you do have a receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And the sender should have a reason to send the communication. And
yes,
the receiver should have a possibility and also a reason to receive this communication.
Indeed.
So for the receiving part, that is pretty straightforward. What about the sender? Why should the sender send this information?
I mean, in insects and fish, it's often explained that fish live in schools, or insects live in hives. So they're often social species that we observe that use alarm pheromones. And with voles, this aspect is a bit tricky, because during mating season, voles are fairly solitary. Females have a very strict territory, while males move around and with overlapping over several female territories. However, when we then go into the winter period, voles often build communal nests. So with that in mind, voles are both a social and to some degree an asocial species. And if it's then, and since females often accept their offsprings within their territory for a prolonged time, it makes sense to warn your direct relatives that the danger is imminent. So you could argue it's a form of altruism, or then it's just a way to improve your indirect fitness, which is an explanation I prefer much more.
So this assumes that the sender is actually sending the information, the same information as the receiver receives. What about there is another focus? I mean, there could also be a communication with a weasel. Maybe this is to deter the weasel from being preyed upon.
I mean, that's definitely an interesting theory, and I would really like to work on that to see how a weasel reacts to a lamp pheromone versus the normal odor of an unstressed vole. But I think my gut feeling is that if the alarm pheromone of a vole would have an effect on the weasel, we would see a much clearer effect in their population dynamics. Weasels, in my opinion, wouldn't be such a major predator for wolves, and they would have a much higher chance to escape a direct encounter. For example, if we compare to some birds sing loudly to when they are chased to deter the predator, showing how fit they are, that it's not worth to chase them. I don't think that the alarm pheromones are comparable to that.
It can also be the opposite, where the predator are manipulating the prey to behave in such a way, so it's actually increasing the predation rate.
So the predator is causing alarm pheromone in wolves, and then wolves carry the alarm pheromone to conspecifics. How would the predator benefit from that?
No, not necessarily the transmission to the other individuals, but the individual itself. If it turns into a stressful behavior, that can very well be not adaptive. I mean, a lot of parasites are really excellent of manipulating their prey to be more preyed upon.
I'm definitely not denying that there's a possibility for that, but honestly, I have not looked into that for my work, but it's definitely a very interesting idea.
So you assume that the weasel is kind of an independent point in this communication, but I just like to discuss the possibility then that there is actually communication between the weasel and the vole, and it can go both ways. The weasel can communicate with the vole, and the vole can communicate with the weasel.
It would be ignorant to assume that weasels cannot detect alarm pheromone. But to then estimate on the relation, if inducing an alarm response in a vole is actually beneficial for the weasel, I don't know. I mean, it's an idea, but I'm not 100% convinced, to be honest.
That's fine. But I was thinking about that the weasel should also be in a lot of stress in these boxes. So maybe the predator odor is a lot of stress, a lot of alarm pheromones.
That's an interesting idea, yes. But we've had studies where I've not been involved, but where a weasel or another mustelid has been running through our enclosures and has not been restrained in any way, and we observed similar responses from both that they were hiding and fearful. But I definitely see your point that keeping a mustelid in captivity is far from a natural setting for them.
Right. So with that, I'm going in now to some other broad issues. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit of a broad critiques. So you have been working on the bank vole.
Yes.
Could you help me through this classification here? I've done a lot of species, most of them from your thesis. I added a few others in the end. So what's going on here on the classification?
I'm not quite sure what your the change from Clitrinomys to Myiodes was a bit before my time, and I'm not quite sure what the issue was at that point to change the classification.
Right. But here, I put the least weasel, Mustela nivalis, and you also put the subspecies, Nivalis nivalis, and then I put Linnaeus, 1766. And I don't have in a bracket there for the Banquo Mulus Glareolus. I put a bracket around Schreber 1780.
Yes.
Why?
I'm not quite following what you're getting at.
Okay, so what happened is that here is the Linnaeus 1766, where he describes a lot of mammal species, a lot of species, but also mammals. So here you see that he has divided the mammalians into primates, into bruta, and ferre. Ferre, that's the carnivores. Mm-hmm. And there you see that he has canis, for example, as one genus. He has felis, but he also has mustela here.
Yes.
But for me, working with Arctic foxes, he doesn't have a vulpes and he doesn't have olipex. He named the Arctic fox to Canis logopus.
Okay.
But in this case, in mustela, he named the mustela in that genus. So you see that he has mustela nivalis and mustela armenia under the mustela. So if I go back here, so Linnaeus named the least weasel mustela nivalis. But he didn't name the lemming Lemus lemus. He named it the moose. So the house mice is Mus musculus. So in the Banquo, it was Schreber who named the species Glareolus, but he named it with another genus. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we put Schreber into brackets to show that it was he who named the species, but not the genus.
Okay.
And you have been varied here a little bit in your text. So you haven't followed the strict classification. It's not a big thing, but I think it is kind of, you know. And then I have another of my disturbances when I read papers, when I review papers, and when I read manuscripts. It is about abbreviations. And you like them a lot, and I do not like them. So here, I've been searching for your abbreviation in a homepage, abbreviation.com. What the most common uses of the different abbreviations are. So the alarm odor, yes, it could be Atlantic Ocean, and the predator odor, yes, it could be police officer or any of these things. I think that you should be a little bit careful with them. The only part where your interpretation of your own abbreviations works sort of, that is giving up density. And also the longer ones where you have more letters in them, the generalized linear mixed model. So you have described the abbreviations, absolutely. But in some cases, you use them in a way so it is rather difficult to understand what's going on. I mean, I rarely, when it comes to my science, I rarely read a paper from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for something. Maybe I'm looking for a method. Maybe I don't care about the method. Maybe I'm just looking for result. And then I'm just thrown into these one or two or three or four letter abbreviations. And it's very popular today, you haven't done it, to use your pet hypothesis as an abbreviation. I mean, this is a shot in the foot. No one can follow you then. You throw away the most interesting part of your paper with a three letter combination. So please stay away.
I will try my very best.
And with that, then I thought that we can go into the different papers. Mm-hmm. So so here in the first paper, here that's really a fundament for the thesis, yes. where you're looking into the effect of fear. The method you have is to time spent in arenas. You have feeding, you have reproduction, and you have stress hormones. And then you have the classic treatments. Mm-hmm. The predator odor, the alarm pheromone, and here you have a social odor also,
yes.
And the control. So can you tell us a little bit about the animals here?
Well, the animals were kept in our laboratories, with I think 12 and 12 hours light cycle, where in our standard rodent cages with food and water as much as they wanted, and as soon as we treated them, we separated them into different rooms to avoid any cross contamination between the treatments, and then within each room, both males and females received the same odor treatment.
Did you have any escapes?
If you I mean, if you handle at that point, I think it was 200 something volts. Yes, you have occasionally somebody that jumps out of your hand that can't be avoided, really, no matter how trained you are.
And what about mortalities?
We checked those, and we keep track of them to make sure that we don't have any infections in the laboratory. So we meticulously write them down every day if we find any mortalities, but it was not any unexpected high or low mortality, like the standard level.
So did you have any favorites, some individuals that you, for one reason or the other, was looking more careful to?
Not really. I mean, volts are not a big fan of being handled, and they make that very clear to you. So if one vole bites you less than the other, that doesn't make it a favorite.
Yes, I can see that. I mean, the classic use, and you bring that up in your introduction, the classic scientific use of voles is to count them, 1, 2, 3, up to a million, sort of. So the classic ecology that's been done on voles is mostly populations. You have really gone into the behavior of different individuals, but you have not really used the individual variation between them. Can you just briefly discuss?
Yes. I now know what you mean. I mean, I could have done some personality studies on individuals to see how the personality relates to some behavioral trait, but I thought it would be more telling if we then move now against my point that I made before about individual fitness to, like, what do wolves do in general, and not what does one specific vole do, because it's, for me, it's more important to see what are the general trends. If I take, let's say, 100 volts, what is the general trend of that 100 volts? What do they do, and not if one vole is now an outlier and is super active or super timid. I get the point to study that and to relate that. But I think for my part, I had a slightly different approach to this.
So what is your basic idea when you work with the animals? Are there big individual differences? Are some very bold and others are shy? Do you see this kind of variation between them?
I mean, you do have outliers in both directions, but on any given summer, those are a handful. I would say less than 10 individuals in either direction who differ notably from the average vole that you work with. I mean, you always have some vole that is super active and jumps around the cage, and some vole that barely moves at all if you put it in a experimental setup, but those are very clear outliers, and the average vole just is somewhat unhappy to be handled, but doesn't mind too much and moves still around if you put it in some arena.
But you have done some behavioral arena tests. Yes. On the voles, but then when you test that, you didn't use the individual to looking into if a more bold individual had more or less reaction on the pheromones or the odors.
We did, I think, in the first experiment, was it where we did the dominance test for the males, which is then one kind of personality to test. And it just showed that it didn't matter. The marking behavior, so whether the male vole was dominant or not, did not relate in any way to the rest of their behaviors.
Right. Okay. So, if we're then looking into the predictions here, so the prediction from this paper was that the control group should be equal to the social odor, which should be different from the predator odor and the alarm pheromones.
You know, now talking about the feeding, right?
That now I'm talking about the feeding and the time spent.
Yes.
And for the breeding, you're predicted that all treatments should breed in different ways less than in the control group.
Yes, definitely.
Is that okay?
Yes.
And if we're then looking into the results, so if we see in the graph there, the the results was really not, it was partly according to the predictions, but partly not.
Yes, indeed.
I think it is very fair of you. I think it is very nice of you to to do the predictions, do the theory, do the prediction, do the experiment, and just let it go and to describe the results. So I think that's very fair to be open to the whole processes. Otherwise, it's common to rewrite your predictions after you have had your results.
It is, unfortunately.
But what's the what kind of comment do you have here?
I mean, if I since I went into the literature that exists on vole weasel interactions and on other predator prey population dynamics, everything tells you that the presence of a weasel should decrease the reproductive output. That's what you read everywhere. So I would have been lying to say I expected the results that I got, because I was not expecting that. It took me quite a while to make sense of this until I found the one paper by Duffield which proposes the dynamic threshold model, which then helped me to actually make sense of what I found.
So that's for the breeding, but the time spent here, mm-hmm. the females, they are attracted by the alarm pheromone.
Yes. Yeah, that's a bit tricky question. I mean, there have been studies before, I think, in rats, if I'm not rats and mice, where they found something similar, that the urine of stressed males was somehow more attractive to female mice. So you could argue that it's some kind of survival, that the females like somebody who survived an attack. They were super stressed, but they made it out alive, so let's mate and have it's a ton of offspring, because they might be able to outrun a weasel in the future. But it's a bit of a stretch to actually write. It's my personal opinion how it could work, but there's not really enough research on this done.
Yeah, no, that's right. So your prediction are based kind of in a coherent idea, but your results are not. Here you take some of the results and discuss it in one direction and the other results in sort of another direction. Mm-hmm. So it would be nice to get, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I discussed what is an alarm pheromone for the voles and what is a predator odor for the weasels. So maybe that is the reason for this kind of different turnouts in the experiments. I don't know. But it's interesting to hear what you have to say.
I mean, it's definitely possible. Unfortunately, if you look into the literature, it's very difficult to relate the results to any other previous study, since there are just so few other research groups who showed an increase in reproduction, for example. So it's difficult. I tried to make sense of my results within the limitations of existing literature. I'm definitely not saying that what my conclusions are the ultimate ones. I'm pretty sure that in a few years somebody will say, well, that was a nice try, but this is how it actually works.
Yes, yeah, that's fine. So, but if we then continue here then with your interpretation, I have done two citations here from your text, but it's basically, it's about the when you compare the predator odor with the alarm pheromone.
Yes.
So you say that in the second citation, these different perceived threat levels differently affected reproductive investment.
Yes.
And in the first one, you say that they have a different reliable risk signaling.
Mm-hmm.
So have you tested the difference between alarm pheromones and predator odor?
On what? On
statistics?
I mean, that's... No, I know what you mean. No, all the results are only comparing it with a control treatment, not with between the treatments.
Why?
To avoid an increased degree of uncertainty. I mean, depending on who you ask, whether post hoc tests on explain in between group levels are should be done or not, you ask three mathematicians or statisticians and you get five different answers. So the people I consulted for my results said, no, stick with your one main baseline and compare everything to it. You should avoid any post hoc tests to make sense of within group variations.
Yeah, so one strategy is to, if you do have significant differences between the groups, then you're allowed through post hoc test to test where are these differences between what groups.
Mm-hmm.
Another is like you have chosen then is to stick on specific hypotheses. But isn't it very central? I mean, you discuss that the different response to predator in relation to predator odor in relation to alarm odor. So you do have a biological hypothesis here. Mm-hmm. And then you should absolutely be allowed to test that.
I see what you mean.
Because you do conclusions on the relationship between the different responses.
In my opinion, the conclusion is more how both of the responses compare to the baseline. But I definitely see what you mean, that by comparing them to the baseline, I necessarily compare between the two.
You never thought about adding the two, the alarm pheromone and the predator odor, to see if they were additive?
We actually talked about that when we designed the experiments, but we saw that it's easier in the beginning to show single effects, and then it could be the next step to show if they are additive or not. But we also then come close to the limits of our laboratory space, how many groups we can house and how many treatments we can apply. So we need to choose carefully what we do with some space restraints.
Yes. I'm in one of my first slides here, I showed the sample sizes for the different papers. I'm pretty impressed by that. You have really a decent sample sizes through all the experiments. But what about a control? You have used what about a control on the control?
Yes, you mean the social odor.
Well, yes, and the order, the ordinary control that you have in all experiments.
Yes. Well, we chose that control just so that they would receive the control animals would then receive the same handling that at every other individual, and the odor should not matter because we always presented them with this with the same bedding material that is already present in the environment, so it should not be any added odor stimulus to them. So we were just making sure that our handling of the animal or putting an additional bedding with odor in, for example, in the first experiment into the cage, the physical act of adding anything to the cage is the cause of the observed changes.
Yes, I agree. This is difficult, but it's always very nice to have a control on the control. And I don't know what that would be here. Maybe it would be because they have been in individual cages. They already know the bedding material
yes.
that you have used as a control. So one control would be to have a bedding material that they have no experience in. That would test the experimental situation per se.
So I see what you mean. For example, just add a handful of, I don't know, hemp shreddings for example to give a different odor. But on the other hand, then you risk that they react to an unknown odor stimulus that they never encountered compared to the mechanical handling of the cage.
Yes.
So you would need then the control of the control, and then the different treatment, which then again brings me to the problem of space.
And sample size.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, yes. Okay, is there anything else you would like to add for the paper one?
Not right now, I think.
Okay. Then I can continue with the second paper.
Gladly.
And here you have a very intriguing experiments with a rather complicated treatment.
Yes.
Could you very briefly describe it and go through what you would expect, basically?
So in the first chapter, we had everything in the laboratory. So we then thought for the second chapter, well, we in the first chapter, we chose who the votes are mating with. That's not very natural. So we decided, let's put the votes in our outdoor enclosures to allow them a more natural mating scenario that they can choose their mates and mate as often as they want with as many individuals as they want. And within the outer enclosures, we then went in there twice per day to trap the animals and to then present them to the three odor groups that you see in yellow, turquoise, and blue on the screen. We then brought them back to the laboratory where they gave birth to pups. And we then, of each initial treatment group, we then made three subgroups. So that's the offspring would also be treated to either the control order, the predator order, or the alarm pheromone. And we presented these in an open field arena, like an extension of an open field arena, because normally an open field arena is completely neutral with absolutely no visual or odor cue. And in this case, we then added an odor cue evenly to the arena.
Okay. yes, this paper is much more difficult to sort of go through the different predictions and to discuss the details in relationship to the predictions. But one basic prediction is that those juveniles that have had a treatment of predator odor in both stages, mm-hmm. they should have a smaller, a decreased behavior in predator odor treatment and in alarm pheromones.
Exactly. There are several studies who already worked with transgenerational effects, and the bigger picture is always if you treat the parents with predator odor, the offspring become more fearful, barely move in any, if you take them in an elevated cross maze, open field arena, or then forced swim test, they just don't want to move at all. So we then assumed that if you have both the parental treatment plus then the repeated treatment for the offspring, it would be an additive effect, and we would see a really, really strong anxiety reaction.
Right. So how did it turn out then?
Well, differently. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Well, we basically were able to show, well, we were able to replicate the standard settings in every previous study. So if the animals receive a predator odor, no, if the parents receive a predator odor, the offspring react fearful in a neutral environment, which is exactly what all the studies so far tell you. However, if you then add an alarm pheromone or a predator odor to the arena, they suddenly move much more. So, which is completely opposite of what all the literature so far tells you.
Right. Why?
That's the big question. So the explanation I have, if you are a vole, the average vole lives at most one winter, so about a year. And within that short time span, it is quite unlikely that the predation pressure around you changes significantly. So your parents encountered a lot of predator odor in their environment, so a high weasel to vole ratio. They transfer that information to their offspring, and the offspring are then born into an environment where the same odor is present, and they say, well, if I don't forage now, I might never be able to forage, because if the vole would just stay hidden and try to avoid the predator, the predation pressure might never ease within its lifetime. So it's somehow forced to go out. And if we then come back to the initial results that I previously have shown, I mean, yes, the offspring show increased anxiety in a neutral environment, but realistically, that does not exist in the field. There is not such thing as a neutral environment. There's always the odor of a conspecific, the odor of a predator, or something else around. So the neutral environment is very artificial.
Yes. So again, here it's not clear what the predator odor is. And it's really not clear what alarm pheromones are also, I think. And again here, what's the difference between the alarm pheromones and predation odor that you discuss again here without really testing it? So are they the same thing on a scale where one is more intensive than the other?
I think it heavily depends on which aspect of the vole's behavior you look at. I think if we look at reproductive changes, yes, I would argue it's definitely is a scale in threat, where predator odor is like a elevated threat level, but alarm pheromone is a really high threat level. But that might have very different impacts on the vole behavior. So depending on what you actually measure then, you might not always see that the alarm pheromone has a stronger stronger effect than the proto odor, because it might not be beneficial to the vole in that situation.
Or maybe the interpretation is wrong in the first case.
Oh yes, I mean I can't deny that.
Okay. So again, here, who is sending what kind of signal? And I think that the I wonder what the weasels are signaling really. You assume that they cannot affect their signaling. You assume that their presence confer a constant signal. I'm here. I'm dangerous.
I mean, I don't say that weasels are actively signaling to voles. Voles are just using the existing odor cues of weasels, which within weasels are then used to, for example, mark territories or to attract females. I don't necessarily say that weasels are actively signaling to voles about the danger. It's more that the voles are eavesdropping on the odor surrounding and using the information given to them.
So the tiger has stripes to be more cryptic, mm-hmm. in the out in the nature, so the prey wouldn't see it, so wouldn't observe it so easily. Don't you think that the predators also would try to mask their odor in a similar way? They would have stripes on their odor.
That's an interesting thought. I would assume that they try to more pay attention on their environment, that they for I know what you mean, but I would assume that it is a fairly complicated approach to actively mask your odor profile. I mean, it's an interesting thought, but
yes, I mean the solution would be that the weasel odor is more important for the communication between weasels. That communication would be more important than to mask the odor for the prey.
Yes, I assume so. That primarily weasels use their odor profiles to communicate with conspecifics, and that the vole just use that information as for their threat assessment.
Yes.
And it would be the same issue with tigers, since tigers also need to mark their territories, either to deter males or to attract females, or the other way around, depending on the sex of the tiger. And I assume that process has a higher, if they would stop the odor signaling to conspecifics, it would have a bigger impact than trying to hide their odor profile to potential prey.
Yes. This is about communication. So, mm-hmm. and a central theme in communication is to lie. And when it comes to visual cues, mm-hmm. There is a lot of lies going on in human communication, for example. And in oral communication between humans, there's also a lot of lying. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to scent, well, I don't know. I react to a scent and I'm just, oh, that smells gorgeously. So what I'm suggesting here, that our ability to tell a lie is very different from the different ways of communication. And it might be that you're correct, and lies in scent marking is more difficult and maybe not so common. So, okay, let's move on to the third paper. And again, a very intriguing experiment, but complicated.
Yes, indeed.
So so here you, we have a lot of measurements here. There are two different stages in how the predation odor and the alarm pheromone, what the reaction they could should have on the different responsible factors, the juvenile growth, the foraging, and time exposure. Please help us.
So the basic idea was there that we showed that presenting both with predator odor or alarm pheromone causes changes in the offspring. We've seen that in the previous experiment. Now the question was, and there's a lot of literature on this, when does this imprinting or the transgenerational information transfer actually occur? And so the biggest two possibilities are either they happen in utero by, for example, increased stress hormones into the mother or other hormones that are triggered as a response, or then it happens during like lactation during with maternal care, that again the hormone content in the milk could change, or then it's due to maternal care in the offspring, either more or less or different maternal care. That's the biggest question now. So we then try to approach this topic by exactly splitting our three treatments into a prenatal and postnatal part, and compare whether they differ or if they have the same effect on the offspring. And as an oversimplification, in most cases, it did not really matter when the odor cue was applied. It just mattered which cue was applied, and that then shaped the behavior of the offspring.
So I'm trying to summarize the predictions and the results a little bit here. So for the first prediction, the juvenile growth should be faster in the predator odor, which should be, and even more faster in the alarm pheromone. And yes, that is the case. And the second predation, which the figure here illustrates, the mother's in predator odor and alarm pheromone postnatal, there the juvenile should avoid the maternal odor. And for the alarm pheromone, they do not.
No.
And for the predator odor, they do. Does this match with your kind of two-step predation scenario?
Honestly, it's a bit difficult. As I said before, I think it matters really highly in what situations the offspring are to induce the cross-generational or transgenerational effects. As in the previous experiment, they were only caused in some specific situation. Now here, we then have not one single odor, but they could choose between three odors and could potentially forage. So that's, I think there's much more which is caused by the alarm pheromone that we are able to show with these experiments. I think the underlying mechanisms are much more complicated and are potentially only shown in really extreme edge cases where the change in behavior is then favorable. It's the same problem as before. When the majority of studies worked with neutral environments, I think the closer we get to actually meaningful ecological experiments, which are arguably really hard to do in a laboratory setting, the closer we get to the truth.
Yes, I agree. So we continue the paper 3 here with the results. And again, here you didn't get the predicted results.
No.
When it comes to juvenile foraging, and here it's kind of odd. So all through the thesis, sometimes the predator odor is attractive.
Yes.
And it's difficult to to find a kind of common general explanation to why sometimes the predator odor is interesting.
I completely agree. It's really puzzling that depending on how you treat them and the way how you present them, the odor, their behaviors completely change.
Yes. Yes. And a fourth prediction. they feed more in predator odor. So I wonder sometimes if we are putting the wrong questions to the experiment. So maybe they can see things in the odor. Now I'm going the other way around. I mean, I'm trying to sort of arguing that the odor is something else here. But maybe they know more. Maybe they can tell more information from the odor than we know. So
I absolutely agree. I would definitely agree that what we now assume that the prey can understand from the odor is oversimplified. I'm pretty sure that a prey species can pick up on subtle differences. For example, there was a paper on field hamsters, I think, where they could show behaviorally that the hamsters were able to detect when the predator has been feeding on other hamsters, but they were unable to quantify that with a gas chromatograph analysis. Yes. So it went beyond our capabilities to measure what the prey was able to detect. So I completely agree. We might actually be asking the wrong questions here.
Yes. So, but it's really, I mean, you're very honest with your results and your experiments, and I really like that. So that's the only way to go, to describe why you did the experiments, how you did them, and what the results are. And then you interpreted it. And then we just need to keep an open eye then on what part do we understand and what part do we understand less. Okay, and the last, we had another fourth prediction here. Yes, so what about these results in relation to your thinking about terminal investment?
What was that again? The time you mean the time spent in you mean the graph or
the overall results from the third paper on terminal investment?
It's difficult. Let's put it like that. I mean, if you look at the growth rate of the litters, it's definitely so support terminal investment. But if you then look at the explorative behavior, it becomes a bit more muddy, let's say it like that. You don't get as clear cut, yes, it's definitely terminal investment, or no, it's absolutely not terminal investment. I mean, if we look at the growth rate, we definitely see that in under the alarm hormone treatment, no matter if it was early or like prenatal or postnatal, big litters grow faster or are of a favorite, which is definitely can be interpreted as a terminal investment, that everything is put into big litters. While then with predator odor, smaller, potentially high quality offspring are of favorite. So a focus on quality and not quantity, which could be then favorable in a like medium threat environment and not necessarily really high level threat environment. But I agree. If we look at the overall picture of the third chapter, some aspects do so support ideas, and some are less clear cut.
Yes. Okay, let's go into the fourth paper. The fourth paper is a little bit different than the other ones. It is a lot of descriptive aims.
Yes.
To find the different pheromones, to find the different molecules about it. And the first graph here illustrates how scared individuals smell, give a different scent. Mm-hmm. So, yes, and then I have one of these sentences that I'm coming back to from the beginning with all the abbreviation. An analysis of the 10 compounds of the interest reveals significantly higher ER in the P treatment compared to both H and C. Taking that out of context, it doesn't say anything, really.
And I completely understand what you mean.
But if we go into the results instead, then, so here you have the social odor also.
Mm.
Do you? No, you don't.
No, I don't. I just have the hand. So the control where
yes.
we.
H is the handling, that's right, yes.
Handling, yes.
Yes, okay. So the results here in the behavior is that again, they like the predator odor.
Yes, they do.
Why?
Well, no.
Could it be the same mechanism as you see on the savanna where the prey species, the antelope species, approach the predator?
I think you have the interpretation upside down. The high giving up density means that they don't forage there, or they forage less.
Okay, they do.
Yes.
So
less in under predator odor compared to control.
All right, fine. So, but that was the only reason then. So they did, so here they do stay away from the alarm pheromone.
Yes, but I mean not significantly different from the control, unfortunately.
The predator odor. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
They stay away from the predator odor and forage at the same level from the alarm pheromone. Just the biggest difference is how much they forage under the alarm pheromone on the second day.
Yes.
Because suddenly, so much more, the drop is really drastic compared to all other treatments.
Yes. Yes. I think, again, this figure demonstrates my urge for testing the differences between predator odor and alarm odor. So it would be interesting to see if there's any difference there between them. So, but that's okay. I don't have much more to comment here. This is a start. This fourth paper is a start to identify the different scents, and I guess to continue with it.
Yeah.
So. On a more broad scale, what is it that you are very proud of in your thesis?
I'm actually very, very proud of the first chapter where we made the bridge between the breeding suppression that many experiments show and the terminal in investment, so the increase in breeding and reproductive output that we can show both results and that they are not mutually exclusive but more part of a bigger picture that has previously not properly been understood, or that the wrong questions were asked.
I mean, and also
that working with alarm pheromones is fairly new. I mean, working with any body odor has not been very common before the last decade. So I think that broadening the question of predator-prey interactions with how do the body odors actually affect what prey and predator do is a very important aspect to understand the bigger picture.
Right. And what are you less happy with?
Honestly, every experiment could have been improved in some way, bigger sample size, looking at some other measurement in hindsight that you see, well, this measurement did not work as expected, we should have done this instead. But I think in the grand scheme of things, I think the experiment that I would like to redo if I would have the time and resources would be chapter 3, because with the 6 different treatments,
yes,
we were definitely stretching our possibilities, and the interpretation got really tricky with all the interactions.
Yes. And if the University of Esquilinar would tell you that you get a postdoc for 3 years to continue these experiments, this aim, where would you go then? What would you do?
I was thinking about two possible possibilities. So the first, we always looked at the effects for only one generation. But in my opinion, it would be interesting to see, well, we looked at the offspring, but how can we actually assess the fitness of the offspring? For example, if we treat the parents with predator odor or alarm pheromone, how fit are the offspring? How able are they to reproduce? How able are they to survive throughout the next winter? Are there any additives effect if we treat 2 subsequent generations or 3 generations? As we would see in the wild with a yearly increase in predation pressure? And does it have any long-term, like multi-generational effects?
So would you then put these experiments into a population cycle scenario? Is that what you suggest?
I have to admit, yes, I thought about that. If what we see here are plays a part in the cycle, as I wrote in the first chapter, there were observed similar things in really high densities. These involved with where vaults were suddenly breeding much more, where even though there was no way that the environment can so support the number of volts anymore. So it might be that if we go, I admit this is I'm not going on a limb, this is a bit crazy. But in my idea, it could be that the extreme peaks in volt fluctuations could be due to terminal investment, that we reach a threshold in the environment where the volts realize they cannot reproduce, and the environment does not support the number of volts present, so they suddenly all need to reproduce to make sure that at least one single of the offspring makes it through the high density phase, and then we see the crash of the population.
A very popular discussion today when it comes to transgenerational effect is the epigenetic effects. Mm-hmm. Have you considered that?
Yes, I would say that's part of the multi-generational aspect. If those epigenetic effects, how are they inherited and do they accumulate over time? Yes, that would definitely be an important aspect to look at, to move away from purely behavioral observation to look more at the genetic side of thing, or even look at more physiological measurements.
Okay, with that, I'm going to give some concluding remarks. So first of all, I must say that it's a very nice thesis, and it's a very exciting work. And I think that you have really produced extremely well in the discussion. You know your animals, you know your experimental situation, and you know the theories in behind. So in conclusion, I state that this thesis in animal ecology has a modern and experimental perspective on effects of sublethal effect on of predation in both an evolutionary perspective and a search for mechanism. Torbjörn Sievert has conducted a series of nice and intriguing experiments where he combines different scales. Some parts of the experiments are based on laboratory exposure, which are then followed by field experiments. This certainly gives new perspective on this subject. This is also partly supported by chemical analysis on hormone levels. The thesis is very well kept together and with four chapters, and that addresses general questions in ecology. It nicely builds on a coherent picture on how scent for a predator and alarm pheromone affects different parts of the life history of voles, including behavior, juvenile growth, foraging, and reproductive output. It is well suited for a PhD thesis in animal ecology, and Torbjörn Sievert has answered all the questions in a very good way. I think that he has very well fulfilled the criteria for a PhD thesis, and I can certainly recommend it to be accepted to gain the degree of Doctor of Philosophy. I warmly welcome its approval by the Faculty of Mathematics and Natural Science. Thank you very much, Torbjörn.
Thank you. If anyone has any critical comments to make on my dissertation, please call the number shown on the screen and ask the Kustos for the word.
If there are no questions coming, which should be the case, I declare the public defense closed. But I would ask you to stay online, and you can use the same telephone number or the Zoom connection chatting for congratulations for the defendant and this chatting with us. And we probably will have a toast with Anders in Stockholm in a minute as we get something to toast with. Thank you for everybody for joining, and we are very unhappy for the beginning.